listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In just the years between 2009 and 2012, over 100,000 African elephants were slaughtered for their tusks. The ivory harvested from those animals is often sold through a complex international network of poachers, militias, and terrorist groups, all of whom are major destabilizing forces on the continent. Although the broad strokes of ivory trafficking are well known, figuring out how all of the pieces of the puzzle connect has been a challenge. Enter National Geographic Director of Special Investigations Brian Christie. He, along with top taxidermists and other experts, developed artificial elephant tusks implanted with custom GPS tracking devices so convincing an ivory trafficker would think that they're the real thing. He has called his cover story for the September issue of National Geographic Tracking Ivory. He is also featured in Explorer, the Warlords of Ivory on the National Geographic Channel, which premieres on August 30th at 8 p.m., just a couple of days. And I'm very pleased to welcome Brian Christie to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
If the current rate of poaching persists, how long will it be before all the elephants in Africa are wiped out?
Well, we've got about 450 to 600,000 elephants, and we're, as you say, we're losing 100,000 every 3 years. So that math paints a very grim picture for elephants.
And I keep on hearing about crackdowns, but doesn't seem to be cracking down very much.
It depends where we're talking about, and you're right. I mean, the killing in Tanzania and the places where we go for this project in Central Africa is extraordinary, and it's not effective.
Because governments really don't care?
It depends on the country.
I mean, one lion, for example, a terrible story, but one lion made national headlines.
Yeah, extraordinary, right? I think that speaks more to something in us here in the United States than it does to what's going on in Africa.
Where did you get the idea to build fake elephant tusks?
Drugs. I thought, look, this is crime. Let's approach this the way we'd approach a narcotics trafficking syndicate, and I'd want to put a tracker inside a cocaine shipment.
So in this case, you put it inside a fake elephant tusk. Where do you go to have them made?
I sent out bids for a while, for months, and what came back from some of the best museums and things was wouldn't pass muster. And then I found in Paterson, New Jersey, taxidermist. I had just done a story on the world's best taxidermist, and this guy was the creme de la creme. He's the American Museum of Natural History's taxidermist, George Dante. And George said, no one's done this before, but I'll give it a try.
But it must be hard to find something that will look just like the real thing.
Yeah, it was, I mean, this was very dangerous. It was either going to work or not, and if it had to look right. It had to feel right. The balance in the hand had to be right. Ivory has a sound, a unique sound because of the density. It's a tooth. And if you tap on it as a trafficker would to test it, it had to pass.
What did you use, plastic?
He used a resin compound. Actually, since the story came out, people have been calling him to find out what exactly he used his compound. It's his special sauce at the moment.
Well, it would be great if all of the ivory we had in the future was made out of resin instead of poor elephant, real elephant tusk.
Right, and he has demonstrated that you can make it so perfectly that it's indistinguishable.
You also needed a custom-built GPS tracker. Who built that for you?
So we found, again, world-class designer of tracking technology. This is a guy, Quentin Kermin, operating in California, who has built trackers that they've put on the Andean bear, on condors, on the pythons that are in the Everglades. And Quentin built me a GPS or a satellite-based GPS system that we installed in these tusks.
Do they send back information all the time?
They operate like a satellite phone, and I can program them from my laptop anywhere in the world. They were programmed to call me twice a day.
I would imagine battery life would be a major consideration.
That's the major. So we use some pretty cutting-edge batteries that give us about a year life.
then you had to plant the tusks so that they would enter the illegal ivory trade. Where did you plant them? You couldn't just leave them down next to a dead elephant.
Right, right. We studied the path ivory was taking out of the Congo and worked to insert them in what we knew to be an ivory trafficking path.
And where? So you put them into one of the early markets, I guess.
That's right.
And then, how quickly did they travel?
They moved about 12 miles a day, and I could watch them again on my iPad, and it was fascinating because they would deliver a phone call to me, basically, or an email, and I would know where they'd been since the last time they got a satellite call.
You had a hard time getting through customs in Tanzania. Did the officials there think they were real?
Yeah. So the bad thing of having a taxidermist make you perfect elephant tusks is you're smuggling now elephant tusks. And I put my suitcase on the X-ray scanner, as you do going through an airport, and basically all the alarms went off, and I was swarmed and arrested. And half the people said he's an ivory trafficker. The other half saw the technology inside, and they said, no, he's not an ivory trafficker. He's smuggling a bomb.
Oh, gee, either way.
Yeah, it was.
How long were you in custody?
About 30 hours, I think, yeah.
Did the fact that you were able to fool airport officials who are trained to look for smuggled ivory reassure you about the quality of the fake tusks?
Absolutely. We were thrilled. George Dante, the taxidermist, was very proud of his work. Yeah.
How did you get released?
Well, we called the U.S. Embassy. They were very helpful. You just keep talking and explaining who you are, and I have support from National Geographic.
My guest is Brian Christie of National Geographic. His article on what he did called Tracking Ivory is in the September issue of National Geographic. There's also a documentary that premieres on the National Geographic channel called Explorer Warlords of Ivory, and that's at 8 p.m. on the 30th.
Yeah, Sunday night.
So we've been talking about poachers, but Warlords of Ivory suggests something else is also happening here.
Yeah, and this was the reason I wanted to do this story. I know pretty well the story of ivory trafficking in East Africa, where it's sort of organized crime, operates like standard drug trafficking syndicates. But in Central Africa, it's a war. These guys, the parks there are remote places, and they're under siege by terrorist groups and rebel militia. Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army is among those.
And they are major traders in ivory?
Well, they're traders in ivory, and they're also traders in humanity. You know, they're the ones that kidnap for child soldiers.
You note that Kony sees ivory as a savings account. In what way?
Well, so he's, in the bush, you have limited ways to buy things. And this is a guy who lives in the jungle. He's been hunted by the United States for years now. And one of the ways he's successful at hiding is he doesn't use any technology. He's not exposed to banks and that sort of thing. So ivory's a way to barter in the bush. And he has the one thing you need to get ivory, and that is he has AK-47s.
To kill the elephants.
To kill the elephants.
And then he buries the ivory or puts it into rivers. Does that affect the quality of the ivory?
No, ivory is very resilient. You can bury it, and it will desiccate. I mean, it'll dry out and affect the quality. But these guys come back on these trade routes every few months.
And is the Lord's Resistance Army trading it for cash or for weapons?
So we interview in this program the ex-soldiers from the Lord's Resistance Army who say they trade with the Sudanese military for arms and medicine.
And so the Sudanese military have enough arms to spare, but they want the ivory because then they can make some extra cash themselves.
That presumably, yeah.
You say that there's been some internal disagreement within the LRA about killing elephants. What's happened to the opponents of the killing?
There was a brief moment when the LRA leadership said, "Look, we're living in the jungle. We have guns. We're killing for food, but we're not going to kill the elephant." There was Vincent Otey was the head peace negotiator for CONI, and he said, "Leave them alone.
We'll kill people. We'll cut off their arms. We'll do all sorts of other terrible things."
Astounding, but right?
This is where we draw the line.
This is where we draw the line. We are, yes, it's amazing. So, and Otey argued, "Let's leave the elephant alone." And he came back and argued with CONI over this, and CONI had him shot.
Now, CONI is Ugandan, but much of this story takes place in Sudan. There are other militias in Sudan. In fact, there's a civil war in South Sudan. Do the militias fight with each other over the ivory?
Whether it's ivory's at stake or yes, in fact, they do. They do come into military contact in Garamba National Park. So the South Sudanese military has come in there, and the Sudanese military, and they do fight. Yeah.
Now Garamba has elephants. Is that one of the reasons it's attractive to these groups?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
There was an attempt to rout the LRA in 2008 with airstrikes. What was CONI's response?
In 2008, they launched Operation Lightning Thunder to try to kill CONI, and they missed him, and his response was incredibly brutal. He and his men went on a killing spree, killing hundreds of people in village after village after village. It was extraordinary.
And they've killed a lot of park rangers as well.
They have.
How do these groups hunt for elephants? How large are the teams that go out into the bush?
Well, this was one of the challenges. The teams used to be large and identifiable, but now they're moving down to just a couple of people. And all you need is a cell phone and a motorbike and an AK, and you can be pretty successful.
Yeah. The AK is a machine gun in this case?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When an elephant is killed, or how are the tusks removed? This is a laborious process, isn't it?
It is. Generally, these guys use a machete to hack out the tusk from the root. But one of the things we saw in this project is apparently people are coming in with helicopters carrying chainsaws. They shoot the elephant through the top of the head, then they use a chainsaw to cut out the tusk.
There was an article in the New York Times the other day that noted that elephant poaching is driving vultures toward extinction because the poachers kill the birds when the birds come to feed off the carcass. They're alerting the park rangers to the fact that there's a dead elephant.
Exactly, yeah. So these poachers, they will poison an elephant carcass to kill the vultures so that rangers can't see them flying overhead and know where they're operating. And that's one of the terrible things. So not only do they kill the vultures, but then the hyenas that come, the lions that prey, there's concentric rings of death that come from these
Will the disappearance of the elephants have other impacts on the rest of the ecosystem?
Absolutely. I mean, the biologists call them the architects of the ecosystem and of the savannah. They provide, just for elephant dung provides important seed dispersal, and there's, taking them out of the ecosystem is yet one other tragedy that's going on.
Elephants are extremely intelligent animals. Have they learned to avoid the sounds of approaching poachers?
Yes, and in fact, one test as I fly over elephant herds that I use to see how much poaching is going on here is how the elephants react to the sign of man. So as I fly over, are they looking at me, shaking their heads back and forth, their trunks in the air in alarm, and then running? Or are they just sort of mildly looking up? And the same when we come approaching a vehicle. What's their behavior?
I'd imagine now they know that helicopters mean danger.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is what we're seeing with these militia groups all that different than when they fight over other resources in Central Africa, whether it is gold or rare metals or wood?
I think what's different, what's important to note, and the reason I wanted to tell this story, is that the park rangers protecting these large areas of land are the only law enforcement on the ground in these areas. So even if Kony or the terrorists are coming in for diamonds or to kidnap children or to rape women, which they do en masse, it doesn't matter whether it's ivory they're coming for or not. What stands in their way is the park ranger. And so they're killing the park rangers because they represent order. So whatever the resource, the rangers are in danger.
And I'd imagine that this is makes recruiting park rangers rather difficult.
Well, surprisingly, these men are very committed. I've met sons of sons of sons who are rangers, and unfortunately, it's not very difficult to find a ranger who's sworn to protect the land because of what happened to his father.
I'm speaking with Brian Christie, who is the Director of Special Investigations at National Geographic. His article on poaching elephants is in the September issue of National Geographic. It's called Tracking Ivory. There's also this Sunday at 8 p.m. A documentary called Explorer Warlords of Ivory that will be on the National Geographic channel. What's driving the demand for ivory? It's no longer being used for piano keys.
Right. It's moved from a Western sort of consumption, piano keys, knife handles, and those sorts of things that we had here. China. China is the driver. China has a long history of carving these incredible sculptures out of ivory. And until recently, their economy has been so bad that they haven't been able to afford ivory. But as soon as the middle class started to get some momentum, they started looking really to the past and wanting to buy these traditional items.
Rather than jade?
Jade, in fact, you'll go to a...
You don't have to kill anything to get jade.
Well, it's funny, the jade counter generally is right next door to the ivory counter in these department stores.
And they, for years, I guess when Westerners came to China and they asked about gold, the Chinese didn't care all that much about gold. They had jade.
Right.
And but they had Asian elephants. Now they go to Africa. There's a very strong presence of the Chinese in various parts of Africa. But the Chinese themselves are not going after the elephants, are they?
The Chinese themselves are generally not the poachers, but they are, you know, we've seen consistently where Chinese construction crews are operating in the remote places in Africa. Poachers will set up and they will form a relationship.
When does the ivory come into the hands of Chinese traders? How early in the process?
Well, so as you point out, on the ground, these infrastructure projects can put it in the hands right on the ground in Africa. There have been instances of diplomats buying ivory in Africa and moving it out in diplomatic pouch.
How much can a pair of ivory chopsticks fetch on the market?
It's amazing. You look at a pair in the counter, and I've been offered ivory a number of times, and they'll sell them for hundreds of dollars. Yeah.
I'm assuming there's a lot of corruption with officials that allow this trade all the way down the line. Is it just in Africa, or does it also occur in China?
The corruption is this sort of consistent, large-scale criminal activity couldn't take place without government complicity all along the supply chain.
As you said, in some cases, diplomats actually smuggling the ivory out. Yeah. You described Sudan as a poaching state. Are there any elephants left in Sudan?
No. The elephant population in Sudan is gone. But it now exports poachers. It is home, as we say, to the Lord's Resistance Army currently, but it is also home to the Janjaweed, the rebel militia who terrorized Darfur.
And they are also going after elephants?
Yes, the Janjaweed have moved all the way across northern Africa on horseback, and they're killing hundreds of elephants at a shot.
In the last few years, Tanzania has lost 60% of its elephant population. Is that all attributable to poaching?
Yeah.
How likely do you think it is that these trends will reverse? A lot of listeners have been calling in to ask what they can do to protect elephants, other than governments burning tusks, which seems to me to be a sad way of having to deal with this. Is there much that can be done?
Well, I think a first level that everyone can do is spread the story. It's surprising how powerful this story is when it's shared, and it doesn't seem like much. But China has recently announced that it's going to do away with its domestic ivory market. And if that happens, it's huge, and it's only because Americans and others have raised an outcry about ivory trafficking.
Hasn't the Obama administration introduced new measures to combat the trade?
Yeah, absolutely. They are working very hard to do away with a domestic ivory trade.
And then we hear every so often, as I mentioned earlier, of the burning of a lot of tusks. Do you think that's an effective way of dealing with this problem?
It's controversial, and it comes from history. In 1989, countries were debating whether to sell ivory or ban ivory trade. The Southern African countries wanted to sell ivory to earn money for conservation, they said. And Kenya stood up and said, no, we want to ban trade. And to symbolize that, they burned their ivory stock. So these countries today are burning their ivory stocks really as a sort of symbolic, callback to that moment.
What about your fake tusks? Has anybody burned any of them, thinking they were real?
This is one of the things. I won't know what happens. They haven't talked to me for a while.
The tusks haven't talked to you, so you don't know what's happened since you made the film?
I do not know where they are or I know where they last communicated to me from, so they may still be in that spot. The batteries may have died, they may have been destroyed, or they may be in a container. They have a thermometer, digital thermometer in them, and that thermometer tells me they're in a place, last count, a few degrees cooler than the ambient temperature, which suggests they've been buried or hidden.
You found the route that they take. Did you talk to officials along the way to tell them that you'd been able to track this and that they might want to crack down at various points?
Well, unfortunately, what we're talking about is a completely lawless area of the world, and in particular in Sudan, the Sudanese government has been the funder of the Lord's Resistance Army. So it would be the same as going to Kony himself and saying, we're on to you.
And now Bashir may very well travel to New York to speak before the UN. There's a big debate over whether to allow him here and then to arrest him or to prevent him from coming here.
Yeah,
but nobody would probably bring him up on charges of ivory traffic.
No, that's the least of his crimes. But you're absolutely right. Bashir is wanted for crimes against humanity and genocide, for the killing in Darfur. And people should know that diplomatic immunity does not extend to heads of state who've been accused under the International Criminal Court for genocide.
Haven't people also killed elephants because they destroy their farms, or because these people actually want to expand farmland into areas where elephants move?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of
that has nothing to do with the ivory.
Correct. And that's not what I'm focused on. I'm focused on the large-scale criminal exploitation of elephants.
I was hoping that you'd bring in an example of your ivory.
Oh, sorry.
Maybe I could get a pair of chopsticks made from him. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, Leonard, thank you for having me.
Brian Christie is the Director of Special Investigations at National Geographic. His article called Tracking Ivory is in the September issue of National Geographic magazine. This Sunday, a documentary called Explorer Warlords of Ivory will be broadcast on National Geographic channel at 8 p.m. What are you investigating now?
Well, I never share what
you don't
I'm
want to
investigating
tell me?
Now.
You're afraid that investigation will alert people to what's happening?
I like to keep things quiet until we've got something to say.
Well, good luck, whatever it is, and I hope that the GPS continues working.
Thank you very much.